attacking her. He was too busy screeching in terror in a puddle of his own urine. At least he didn't try to pray to Alita as the vampire fell upon him and tore his throat out with her fangs. She giggled and danced as the blood sprayed across her face like rain, and she drank straight from the torn jugular like an open faucet. She wasn't even that thirsty, but a healthy human's blood tasted like sweet nectar compared to that greasy ogre mess. Later, she'd have to burn her dress and buy a new one, but it had been worth it. She memorized the guards' faces, because she knew she'd have to make quite a few visits to the Netherworld in the following years, and she had no intention of surviving on animal blood like Lord Wraith intended her to.
"It's probably some kind of test,"
she told herself, although with little conviction. Some dungeon lords were very peculiar. They made up the strangest tests for their minions, expecting nonsensical answers. Depending on the dungeon lord, failing their tests could have lethal consequences. It wasn't fair, but that didn't bother Yarlan. She had enough experience dealing with dungeon lords to make sure that another minion would take the test first. After that, it would be easy to figure out what kind of response the dungeon lord wanted. So far, Dungeon Lord Wraith hadn't abused the minionship pact to punish a faltering minion, but it was only a matter of time. And one way or the other, Yarlan would figure him out. She stopped by her favorite seamstress, a fat gorgon that used her hair tendrils to speed up her work. When Yarlan left the store, she was wearing a dress fashioned in a style that had been all the rage in the Netherworld only a few decades ago. A fitted black piece with a high neckline, long open sleeves, a laced corset, and a multi-layered skirt decorated with multiple bows. Had she been back in her normal form, that of a beautiful corpse in her mid-30s, she would have gone with something more modern, perhaps black leather and brass tracks. But in the meantime, she knew that the classics never really went out of style. She also got a black umbrella to protect her skin. Technically, since the Netherworld lacked real sunlight and was bound by perpetual twilight, she was in no risk of burning to a crisp if she stayed out too long. But the brightness bothered her eyes and, if she wasn't careful, could mess with the internal magic that protected her body from decay, as well as give her face an ugly green tint that would be a bitch to regenerate. Now it was time for business. The first official stop of the day was to pay a visit to the local Dark Temple. It was a black mass that occupied an entire bulb of the Citadel, its walls filled with ample open windows and murder holes so the winged inhabitants of the Netherworld could happily come and go. The eerie chanting from the slaves reached her ears long before she entered the temple. After wandering around the torture chambers, which were purely recreational, and through the Garden of Skulls, she caught sight of a priest she'd had dealings with in the past. The once supple and strong Naga was now old and brittle, his shiny green scales turned milky white from time and the strenuous life as a dark priest. He didn't recognize her in her diminished form, but she quickly refreshed his memory by whispering a few choice words in his ear while he preached to a group of would-be warlocks about the virtues of the dark. The priest immediately shut up and glanced at her with wild, fearful eyes.
"Yes, darling, it's me,"
Yarlan said, laughing at the Naga's bewilderment.
"How about you tell your students to piss off and come have a chat by the Skull Garden?"
The old priest began to pretend he didn't remember the favor he owed her, but Yarlan made sure to mention, several times, her position as a minion of a dungeon lord with the regent's favor. And soon enough, the priest was all pleasant smiles and empathetic nods as she gave him a long list of demons and assorted dark entities she'd need to populate Lord Wraith's new dungeon.
"The imps and the junkers shouldn't be a problem,"
the Naga told her, wringing his hands nervously.
"Sadly, I can't help you with the rest of the list. No, really, Yarlan, I'm serious. Even if the temple could summon a devil knight to fight for you, the truth is, Dungeon Lord Edward Wright has performed no act of dark piety at all since his investiture. Despite Murmur's goodwill, Wright hasn't sacrificed a single prisoner and hasn't paid tribute to the dark, nor has he contacted our temples or priests. By Murmur, the most he's done is erect a single unholy altar in our name, and not once has he prayed there, or even made a demand for more power. How are we supposed to help him out when he refuses to play by the rules?
Yarlin rolled her eyes.
I'm sure Lord Wraith has his reasons. Are you really going to give up so soon, K.U.? What a shame. Almost as shameful as your reputation will be if what we did back in Ephyr reached the Archpriest's ears.
The priest's eyes widened in fear.
Please, Yarlin, understand. Even if I were to draw the magical circle, light the black candles, and sign the incantations, anything stronger than a junker would refuse to help you. Worse, the Devil Knight would probably kill all of you just for bothering him. If you really need the Dark's help, have your master perform the rites, and then we can talk. But before that point, my hands are tied, he said.
Very well. I let this stand. This time,
Yarlin said. She made a mental note to bring the matter up with Lord Wraith once the time was right.
But I still need something bigger than a junker for our grand finale. Come on, K.U. There must be something you can do to help.
The old priest sighed and rubbed his arms.
Maybe there is something, he mumbled. You didn't hear this from me. But remember the corpse architect that disappeared after the shameful zombie accident a few years ago? Word in the temple is he's back in the Citadel. Perhaps you should have a word with him. I think he has refused to work with any dungeon lord since the accident. But if you're persuasive enough, who knows?
Yarlin's tight lips drew into a cruel smile.
Tell me more,
she said. Broom Street was a witch's dream come true. It was a long, sinuous road parallel to Grimoire Boulevard, its buildings cramped against each other like twisted trees fighting for sunlight. Shoddy rooftops loomed over Levy and her retinue as they explored the mysterious shops that lined the paved limestone road. Half the locales on Broom Street lacked a name or any identifying sign. They were little more than huts with glass displays showing totems, dried animal parts, pelts, skulls of endangered monsters, and brass cages for golden snakes and rats with far too many pairs of eyes. The owners were dirty men or women from distant Haligian hills with no name, or shaggy clansmen from the swamps that surrounded the mountains in the Lothian countryside. They were strange fellows with undecipherable customs, just as eager to bless you or curse you if you looked at them the wrong way. Or any way at all. The other half of the street was where true danger lay. Fancy storefronts with glass doors lined with bronze, names like Iridium's Bazaar, Botanica Magica, or Cures and Curses hanging from elaborate signs next to their displays. An untrained apprentice could easily think that Iridium's Bazaar was the safest store to shop for her master's new tunic, instead of that suspicious muddy hut with an old gnome hag who kept scowling in the apprentice's direction and spitting on the ground. The apprentice would spend a small fortune on an ermine tunic lined with sendal, enchanted with flight, only to discover when her master wore it that the tunic was actually a transmuted curse wing, a kind of blood-sucking, flying, sheet-like monster native to Raga. The curse wing would wrap around the very surprised master and take off, thus teaching the apprentice a valuable lesson in reading the fine print of an item's description. If the apprentice went back to Broom Street, she'd discover that Iridium's Bazaar had disappeared overnight, leaving behind an entirely different, but just as threateningly unthreatening, shop. In short, Levy found that Broom Street was the best place in the world to buy the sort of spectacular spells needed to do any kind of decent research. A lesser witch may have gone mad with the power of having a near-unlimited credit line backed by the Regent of Zovia, but Lavina Odessa Treville of the Haunt was a consummate professional, with a will of steel and an ironclad restraint that made her the perfect woman for the job. The last few hours, she'd resisted the allure of the cursed artifacts and exotic garments from distant lands and focused exclusively on the mission at hand. Of course, to buy the spells and magical items that Ed wanted and that she needed for her laboratory, she first needed to earn the respect of the shopkeepers. If they mistook her for an apprentice, they may attempt to con her. So she had had to buy a beautiful scarlet cloak lined with miniver, as well as a golden brocade vest with a skulls and flowers pattern. Obviously, she couldn't strut around wearing dirty shoes with her new clothes, so she was forced to buy a new set of ivory satin shoes with a rhinestone buckle and lace trim. Since she wasn't a credulous apprentice, she hired a pair of ogre thugs to shake the shopkeepers around a bit to make sure nothing in her new wardrobe was actually a centipede in disguise. This proved wise. The first set of shoes turned out to be cursed and would have forced her to dance until passing out had she worn them. After her ogres finished presenting a formal complaint in Levy's name, the shopkeeper's assistant had offered the witch plenty of apologies and discounts while the shopkeeper was carried off to the nearest priest. The discounts were so good that it would have been a disservice to the haunt to let them go, so Levy had been obligated to buy half the inventory. By the time she left the store, she had so many bags that the ogres couldn't carry them all. So, once again, she was in the distasteful position of having to rent a carriage. It was self-evident, though, that moving by carriage in a crowded street was very hard without a pair of lackeys to part the crowd for you. So, Levy was forced to call upon Corgoron's credit once more, sure that she was acting strictly in the haunt's best interest.
"Out of the way!"
exclaimed her golden-haired lackeys as they cartwheeled and danced across the middle of the street, the pair of undead horses that pulled Levy's carriage only a few steps behind.
"Make way for the beautiful and talented Lavina the Witch! Out of the way!"
Safe from the jealous glances of the rabble in the road, Levy relaxed in her comfortable seat as the carriage made way through Broom Street. She was surrounded by piles of parchment and rows upon rows of boxes filled only with the most necessary pieces of magical gear. She glanced out the window.
"I like that store,"
she told Jakesh, her Naga shopping assistant.
"What do you know about it?"
The storefront that Levy was pointing at was of grim black wood, with an ebony sign proclaiming in silver lettering, "Welcome to Clarence Cauldron's Wondrous Runes and Relics Shop." It had no display, and the interior was hidden from view by a black curtain hanging behind the glass door. Jakesh frowned and adjusted his brass spectacles.
"Clarence Cauldron? I've never heard of that name. How strange. I could have sworn this storefront was empty in the morning."
The Naga's tail shifted nervously.
"Excellent,"
said Levy. She rapped on the wooden panel in front of her with her ivory cane.
"Driver, you may wait for us here."
At a signal from the driver, the lackeys hurried to open the door for Levy, then threw a rug on the street before helping her down, so she wouldn't have to sully her new shoes. In doing this, she was merely protecting the assets of the haunt. She waited on the street, surrounded by her servants, for her ogres to catch up with her on foot. As she waited, half a dozen halflings with shaved heads and dressed in ragged togas headed her way. Levy's lackeys stopped them before coming too close.
"Excuse us, madam,"
a halfling told her.
"We're looking for our master. He, gets into all sorts of trouble when he drinks and hasn't shown up in days."
At that moment, the ogres arrived.
"No talking with Master Lavina,"
one of the brutes said, and the two of them ushered the halflings away. Levy shrugged and went inside Wondrous Runes and Relics. The walls were surrounded with rows of packages and assorted items that reached the ceiling, with tables full of trinkets and gadgets, and magical braziers that wavered with a non-existent breeze. A bald man with an oversized head and three azure eyes walked out from behind the counter and headed toward the witch. His skin had a vaporous texture to it, as if he somehow was in two places at once.
"Ah, welcome, welcome to my humble store. I am Clarence Cauldron, at your service."
He shuffled toward Levy, his head bobbling with every step.
"What can I do for you, my fair lady? Allow old Cauldron to fulfill the true desire of your heart. Perhaps you desire to level your beauty like warriors upgrade their battle talents?"
With one hand, he rummaged through the nearest pile of trinkets and pulled one of them out, seemingly at random. It was a simple silver-leaf circlet.
"Behold! With the circlet of Princess Parastar, you can become the very likeness of an eternal elven maid. It can be yours at the fair price of 10 vipharas.
He waggled the circlet at Levi. The witch grinned, took the circlet, and handed it over to Jakesh. The Naga examined it with a critical eye, then shook his head.
This circlet would have enchanted your ears to grow pointy and set you under a compulsion to think you're eternally young every time you wear it.
What?
Clarence Cauldron smiled nervously.
Where did you get that idea?
He stepped back as Levy's ogres strolled his way, patting their batons against their huge hands.
I'll take it,
Levy said.
Toss it with the other, Jakesh.
An excellent choice,
Cauldron said, keeping a careful eye on the ogres. The Naga grimaced.
But, Madame Lavina, that's a cursed item. You cannot possibly think to use it—
Of course not,
Levy said.
Ha! A circlet to make me more beautiful?
She scoffed at the idea.
Why, that's like spitting into a river to make its waters wetter.
Then, what use could you have for it?
Jakesh asked.
Simple. When I return to my laboratory, I shall take it apart and discover its inner workings. What better way to learn curses than to study cursed items themselves? It's much cheaper than searching for expensive scrolls in any case. And I'll train my skills in the process,
Levy explained. Then she grinned and turned to face the shopkeeper.
But since the circlet is cursed, I'll give you only one vifara, Master Cauldron. Is that all right with you?
A vifara? Cauldron exclaimed. I wouldn't break even with that amount.
Levy shrugged.
Well, if you don't take it, I'm afraid my associates here will certainly break something of yours. You did try to curse me, after all.
With a slow and deliberate movement, one of her ogres swiped the trinkets off one table.
No, what are you doing? Oh, God.
The noise of broken glass and crumpled wood drowned Cauldron's protests. The second ogre strolled to the rose by the back.
Fine,
Cauldron exclaimed, his three eyes wide with fear.
The vifara is all right.
Perfect,
Levy said. She walked among the shelves with an appraising eye, with Jakesh and the shopkeeper hurrying to match her pace.
What else do you have for me?
Cauldron bit his lip and reached for one shelf, this time without his previous cockiness.
Well, I have this Batblin paw. It grants the user three wishes.
Throw it in the pile. That's another vifara for you,
Levy said. Her grin grew several inches wider at the shopkeeper's expression.
What else do you have for me?
Broom Street was a witch's dream come true. Ed watched while the line in front of his table grew as people all across the Citadel heard that the Haunt was on the lookout for new minions. The Dungeon Lord sipped his drink and relaxed as Alder, who had the highest charm of the bunch, handled the interviews.
My patron grants me experience points according to how many innocent souls I sacrifice to them,
said the elven warlock currently facing Kes, Alder, and Ed.
If I'm to work with you, I need to take into account the amount of experience points I am to earn. Tell me, how many innocent prisoners do you capture in any given year? And how many of those would I be allocated for blood sacrifices?
Alder turned to Ed, who was making a slashing motion with his hand across his neck. The bard turned to the warlock and smiled politely.
Thanks for passing by. We'll call you if anything comes up.
After the warlock came the leader of a roving band of werewolves. He wanted money and prey to hunt, which could be arranged, but the hairy man bowed out when he heard where the Haunt was located.
Undercity's a damn honey trap, he said gruffly. The Heligian Navy won't let anyone escape by sea, and the Inquisitors of Galtia will hunt anyone down that tries to escape the other way around. Sorry, Dungeon Lord, it's too risky. I would make for a lousy mercenary if I chose to fight a campaign with poor exit strategies.
Kes sighed as the werewolves left. A pair of Naga clerics walked out when they realized Ed wasn't willing to install a blood fountain in their quarters so they could perform their rituals.
Does the Dark really make their clerics use blood fountains for their rituals?
Ed asked, fighting the urge to pull at his hair in frustration.
Actually,
Alder said,
I think that was an excuse.
According to my empathy talent, the clerics had mentally checked out when we told them how much we could pay them.
Kes frowned.
Don't we have Corgaron's credit?
Only for a couple days, Ed said. Salaries are on our tab, and we can't strain the cash flow from the brewing business. If we invest too much on minions that are only useful for fighting, we won't be able to expand our business. It's the old real-time strategy conundrum. We have to choose between early game aggression or a strong late game economy.
You lost me, Alder admitted.
I mean, we need to keep our expenses in check so we can hire a merchant ship in the future and sell our booze all over Steravos. On the street outside, a pair of assholes kept screaming at the crowd to get out of the way of a black carriage pulled by undead horses. Alder, who seemingly was incapable of listening to business talk for more than a second, turned distractedly to the carriage past the window.
Someday, we'll have that kind of money.
I don't know,
Kes said.
Even if we did, what kind of asshole drives a carriage through a crowded street?
Ed's plan was to hire minions that had specialties other than killing people, so that the Haunt wouldn't go broke trying to bankroll an army it couldn't sustain. Sadly, that weeded out a good chunk of the current prospects. Still, Alder hired a group of artisan trap makers led by a gnome inventor that had been exiled from his community because of his profound lack of respect for basic safety protocols. Half of his shiny blue hair was missing, burnt off by an explosion a long time ago. He was willing to work on the cheap, as long as he could remain in Zovia, which was all right with Ed. After the trap makers, they ran into some trouble, because the remaining minions demanded higher wages when they heard that they'd be headed to Undercity. Like the werewolves, most people knew it was too risky to have a couple portals be all that kept them safe in case shit hit the fan.
"We cannot pay that at the moment,"
Alder told a golden succubus dressed in a white tunic.
"But you could marry me, and then you'd have half my stuff." "Okay, see you around then,"
he waved at her as she flew out in a huff.
"She's totally into me,"
he told Kes.
"Our budget is a bit tight, but think of the experience,"
he attempted. But the Ekathunian poisoner, also an accomplished chef, left without letting him finish. Little by little, the line of prospects thinned.
"Sure, work will be hard and possibly lethal, but think of the sense of pride and accomplishment you'll get."
Outside, a group of bald halflings were handing out pamphlets with the drawing of a missing person on them, but everyone continued walking, not paying them any mind.
"Think about your future work offers,"
Alder exclaimed, more than a little desperate. Hours later, there was only one prospect left, a floating blue pufferfish who sounded young, although Ed didn't know enough about floating pufferfish biology to make a guess at his age.
"I do, all the time,"
the pufferfish said nervously.
"Master Alder, Lord Wright, I really need the job. No dungeon lords are willing to hire an untested diviner because of the risk of angering objectivity. But the Zovian School of Advanced Divination won't teach someone without 5 years of field experience."
"Risk of angering objectivity?"
Alder muttered, giving the pufferfish a worried sideways glance.
"No one told me about that."
"There's nothing to be concerned about,"
the pufferfish hurried to say.
"I'm very careful, I swear. In any case, I specialize in enchantments, making crystal balls, for example. Scrying is what's truly dangerous."
Ed, Kes, and Alder exchanged a knowing glance. They could use a diviner who specialized in enchanting to help Levy with her dish research. The dungeon lord massaged his chin. There had to be a way to convince the pufferfish to work with lousy pay and in constant mortal danger.
"I don't know," Ed said, as inspiration struck. "You look quite young, and the Haunt gets a lot of applicants."
Kes raised an eyebrow, but Alder caught on and played along.
"There are at least a dozen diviners who would like to work for us,"
he told the pufferfish. Technically, it wasn't a lie. There were a dozen diviners who would like to work for the Haunt, if the Haunt could pay them more, and if they didn't have to travel to Steravos.
"But I'll work harder than anyone else,"
the pufferfish said desperately. Ed felt a pang of guilt for toying with the diviner's feelings, but he had to play with the hand he'd been dealt. "Look," he said, "understand that if we hire you, and I'm not saying we will. We won't be able to pay you as much as a full-fledged minion, since you haven't completed your training." The pufferfish nodded with enthusiasm.
"I understand. My Zovian school degree will make up for that. Once I get it."
"Only if the student loans don't drown you first, kid," Ed thought, shivering at the memories. He decided that if the pufferfish handled himself well enough, he'd get a raise as soon as the haunt could afford it. "Screw it," the dungeon lord said, turning to Alder. "Let's give the kid a chance."
Alder smiled. "You're hired." There are features of a city that were ever present, regardless if the city was a corrupt port under Heligian occupation or a citadel from what could be argued was the Ivalian version of hell itself. Taverns were one such fixture. This tavern was one of the seediest places in the citadel. The Innocent Slime Girls pub was populated by exiled minotaurs with no home in Ivalis and no options other than coming to the netherworld to survive. Nagas that had been rejected for the priesthood or Corgoron service, and assorted humanoids not fit for taking the minionship. It was also currently occupied by a group of Kuftar monster hunters. One of them, Yumia, was standing next to the door with a carefully maintained, disinterested air. She regarded Yarlan's approach with a raised eyebrow and a hint of a snarl.
"Vampire!"
the Kuftar said.
"Get your business done elsewhere! We're busy here!"
There was a crash of a nearby window as some lowlife was thrown clear through.
"It looks that way,"
Yarlan said.
"But my business is inside, sadly. Aren't you supposed to be working?"
"We are holding auditions for our next teacher,"
Yumia explained.
Yarlan raised an eyebrow.
"It looks to me like you're starting tavern brawls all over the citadel."
"The best way to find the greatest warriors in the city is to fight everyone in it."
"Of course."
Yarlan's smile became a bit strained.
"Do as you wish. I won't get in your way."
She shouldered past the monster hunter, trusting that Lord Wraith's pact of minionship would prevent the both of them from coming to blows.
"Here, hold my umbrella,"
she told Yumia. The tavern brawl was reaching its climax. Most of the furniture had been torn to shreds, the floor was littered with battered nobodies gasping for air, and a Kuftar was standing on a table and howling like a madman as he fought off a couple Akathunians with a table leg. Yarlan's height, or her lack of it, came to her advantage. She walked through the chaos with no one taking notice of her. The bar was empty, save for a sullen man in a black suit hunched over in the corner, and a shell-shocked bartender who was cleaning a glass tankard with a dirty rag.
"You're missing the show,"
Yarlan told the man as she sat next to him and gestured at the bartender.
"Aren't you too young for alcohol?"
the man asked while the bartender poured some tepid ale in the tankard, then slid it over the table straight at Yarlan, who caught it without a second glance. She passed the tankard to the man.
"For you. You look like you need it."
He ignored the gesture, his gaze lost somewhere in the distant land of memories. Behind them, someone flew through the air and crashed against the floor a few feet away from the fireplace.
"I've been looking everywhere for you, Dr. Frederick."
"I'm not for hire, vampire. Not anymore."
Yarlan frowned. Had she not wanted something from him, she would have torn his throat out for speaking to her as if they were equals. She opened her mouth to respond, but paused as a tan halfling wearing some kind of brown tunic climbed atop the chair next to them.
"Terribly sorry, missy. Terribly sorry. Are either of you going to drink that?"
the halfling asked. Without waiting for an answer, he grabbed Frederick's tankard and took several long gulps.
Sorry. Sorry, don't mind me. I'm just passing by."
A Kuftar jumped him from the back, and the halfling absentmindedly smashed his tankard against the monster hunter's forehead, spewing ale everywhere.
"All right, then. Nice meeting ya."
The halfling charged back into the fray, kicking and punching like a small tornado, which was a small marvel, seeing that he was so drunk he could barely stand.
"Anyway,"
Yarlan said.
"Yes, I've heard you refuse to perform the work that made you famous, good doctor, and that the regent herself can't make you reconsider. A shame, really. Goodwill doesn't last forever."
"Let me take a look at you."
Dr. Frederick glanced at her for the first time.
"Nightshade, less than 2 centuries old. Not your first botched regeneration, either." Recently fed. A fine undead specimen, yes. In a different time? No, in another lifetime. I could have crafted beautiful art out of your flesh. But those days are long gone.
He shook his head.
You don't understand, vampire. You cannot fathom the pain that lurks in my soul, tearing at me from the inside.
He showed her his open palms.
These are the hands of an artist. But that same art killed my wife. The love of my life. How can I accept the song of scalpel and gauze when every time I close my eyes I see the fire—
Excuse me, I think there's been some kind of error,
Yarlin said.
You mistook me for someone who cares.
The doctor shut up. Behind them, the drunk halfling gave a howl, and shortly after, Kaga sailed through the air past the bar, only inches away from Yarlin. The Kuftar disappeared behind the bartender, who did his best to ignore this. There came the crash of broken glass, and then Kaga reappeared, pelt disheveled and covered in pieces of bottles, a wild look in his eyes.
Get me that halfling! He bellowed as he jumped back into the fight. We don't leave the Netherworld without him!
As I was saying,
Yarlin said,
I don't care about your backstory. I'm building a quick dungeon, and I need something big and angry to put at the end. Something that won't die the instant the heroes look its way. Since you aren't working at the moment, money must be tight, right? There must be some creature you've stashed away somewhere that you can exchange for this?
She set a heavy bag full of Vifaras on the table.
It's enough to pay for quite a few months of moping around looking like an idiot.
Dr. Frederick clenched his jaw, but his eyes remained on the bag. He glanced doubtfully at the bartender.
Your tab is running quite high, sir, the bartender reminded him.
The doctor sighed.
I may have a little something, he told Yarlin.
The haunt's portal chamber buzzed with activity as, a few days after their departure, the expedition returned with their hands full of loot and empty coin purses. Following the strict security measures established by Marshal Kess, the portal was guarded by two rows of horned spider warriors and a team of elite janitorial batblins going through a checklist as, one by one, the minions stepped out of the portal.
Wed Bard, human,
said Strit as Alder reached the batblin's spot in the checkpoint. Strit checked his wooden tablet. There was a parchment with a list on it. Since he didn't know how to write or read, someone had helpfully drawn the faces of the expedition for him. He found Alder's visage as a rosy-cheeked male with blonde hair and scratched it.
Move along, citizen,
he said, waving the bard in.
A witch, human.
Strit marked a scratch through a drawing of a girl's face with a pointy hat on her head.
Go on.
Levy was followed by a group of drones carrying bags and bags of loot of all shapes and sizes. Strit could swear he saw a batblin paw jutting out of a box at some point. Once the drones were done piling the bounty against a corner of the room, they headed back into the portal. After Levy came Kostel and her guard team. Strit frowned and turned to his second-in-command, Janitor Thuttle.
What number comes before five?
Thuttle showed Strit the extended palm of his right hand, along with a single finger from the left.
This many.
Strit nodded knowingly and scratched every human face in his list that wore a bucket helmet.
Don't get yourselves in any trouble now,
he admonished the humans as they stepped past him. Then the Kuftar monster hunters arrived, and both Strit and Thuttle exchanged worried glances. What in Hogbus's name were they supposed to do if there were more drawings than fingers on their hands? Strit said, thinking fast.
Is your group complete?
He asked Kaga. The Kuftar leader looked a bit worse for the wear, with a black eye and a bloody nose, but he seemed otherwise cheerful.
Anyone missing that we should know about?
Not at all,
Kaga said, patting the batblin on the back.
Very well, move along then, but we'll keep a close eye on you,
Strit said. As the Kuftar marched past, he made a show of scratching their faces one by one. Then he stopped, frowned, and turned to Thuttle once more,
Thuddle, do you know if Kuftar younglings are hairless?
Thuddle examined the half-sized, hairless humanoid that stumbled around with the Kuftar group, the figure wincing at all the sharp lights and clutching his head as if he were afraid it'd fall off of his neck.
Yes,
Thuddle said.
I reckon that's just an ugly baby Kuftar. Are you sure?
Strid asked. Thuddle had a reputation for making things up instead of admitting he had no idea what he was talking about.
He looks quite hungover to be. Well, of course,
Thuddle said, hands on his hips with an air of superiority.
Kuftar start drinking young, so they stop getting hangovers when they're adults. It's like that story where the shaman injected himself with a bit of spider venom, with a bit more every day, until he was completely immune.
Strit scratched his belly.
That makes sense.
Then it was time to account for the host of horned spiders, and soon enough, he'd forgotten all about the Kuftar. Hours later, by the time Strit and Thuddle were almost done, they saw the armored figure of the Dungeon Lord emerge from the portal. He, the Marshal, and the vampire Yarlin were directing the drones as the creatures pulled on some chains. Strit watched in awe as a wagon slowly emerged from the portal, carrying a cage so big it barely fit through the portal. Some sort of creature lay inside the cage, a powerful snout framing a pair of red, shiny eyes carrying the glint of a predator. It had long horns that could impale a row of batlins without much effort. Strit saw powerful muscles at rest, stitched together as if they came from many different animals.
What is that?
He asked, instinctively taking a few steps back. He hoped the janitors wouldn't have to deal with an escaped... whatever that thing was. Yarlin smiled and patted the iron bars of the cave.
This,
she said,
is our boss fight.
Chapter 21. Test Dungeon. The fragile light of the scented candles arranged on her window's ledge mixed with the pale blue shine of Lisa's computer monitor. She was in her pajamas, chomping on a cookie with one hand and working through Ivalis Online's character selection screen with the other. She was home alone. Her sister had gone out again to meet with those marketing hotshots at the club. Before leaving, all dolled up, Diana had suggested that Lisa could still meet up with them if she hurried to toss on some makeup and borrowed a dress from Diana's closet. Both of them knew it was an empty, if well-intentioned, offer. Lisa wasn't a nightlife kind of gal. The music was too loud and the smoke turned her hair into a mess. Besides, why would she be out dealing with the advances of drunk assholes when she could be saving some virtual world or another?
Aw, I keep telling yourself that's why,
she said through a sarcastic chuckle.
Let's pretend it isn't because of the crippling social anxiety.
She cracked her knuckles and selected one of her clerics, a test character that she wouldn't mind losing while the new kid learned the ropes. The screen powered through a loading screen and then flashed white as the music of the Light's Temple began to play. Soon, Lisa glanced at her cleric from the typical top-down perspective of most isometric RPGs. The pixelated graphics showed a checkered black-and-white floorboard and an ample vault with carved statues of the light gods lining the walls. About a dozen other player characters came and went to and from the portal built above a raised dais surrounded by golden candles, right above a huge painting of Alita, first among the gods. The goddess was clad in golden armor that covered her body in many layers of protection and made it seemingly impossible for her to raise her shoulders. Her white hair escaped from the back of her helmet and cascaded down her pauldrons like a snowstorm. She held Akrath, the goddess-turned-spear, in both her hands as Alita challenged the forces of the dark, implied by the painter by a black smudge by the corner of the landscape, right where Alita was aiming Akrath's tip. Mark arrived a few minutes after Lisa, using a low-level fighter to test the waters, although armed with a high-level axe borrowed from his main account.
I hope you don't mind losing it if shit goes sideways,
Lisa told her friend once they were done connecting through TeamSpeak.
Yesterday I got a new one, so it'll be okay, I hope,
Mark said.
So, how's your Saturday night going so far, Liz?
The unmistakable sound of a soda can being popped open came through the speakers.
Same as yours, asshole,
Lisa said.
Well, I was just wondering if you'd be off to some mysterious new high roller job after getting that headhunter's letter, you know?
Lisa's smile faltered.
Actually, I haven't talked to them at all.
The other player characters flowed around Lisa and Mark, who remained like motionless, pixelated statues as they chatted.
Really? Perhaps you've become attached to our magnificent laser shark empire?
Mark asked.
That's not it. It's just... there's something iffy about that calling card.
In fact, she'd kept it at the very end of the bottom drawer of her desk ever since she arrived home with it, and had refused to look at it twice. Something about the way Mark had described the man who'd left her that card gave her goosebumps.
I see,
Mark said thoughtfully.
Perhaps it's for the best. One can never be too sure when you're going to go for an interview and discover a familiar black couch right next to the interviewer's desk. Although, starring in one of those videos pays better than minimum wage, right? Perhaps it is your big shot after all.
A few seconds later, Omar logged in.
Sorry?
The new kid asked, caught right in the middle of Lisa's choice words for Mark.
Not you,
she said through Mark's chuckles. She clicked on Omar's character and confirmed it was one of Ed's test wizards, a mid-level one he carried around to check out new game areas.
How was the campaign? You finished it already?
Sure,
Omar said.
Way too short and tropey, but I liked it. The final battle reminded me of Final Fantasy VI because the last bad guy kept changing shapes.
This prompted a brief but passionate discussion about which Final Fantasy game had been the best one. Ryan arrived during Mark's passionate speech about Cloud and Sephiroth's secret relationship. When the Rylan Silverblade name on the friend list turned green, both Mark and Lisa shut up as if caught by the effects of a mute spell.
Ah, good.
Ryan's smug voice came from Lisa's headphones, sounding slurred.
Everyone's here. Saves me the trouble of herding cats.
He laughed to himself.
Is he drunk?
Lisa thought, frowning. It was a Saturday night, and Ryan was rich. Sometimes she wondered what would prompt a guy like him to spend his weekends forcing people he didn't even like to play with him, when it was clear he had time to have a social life, if he chose to.
Hey, boss,
said Omar.
What are we going to kill tonight?
You don't have to lick his boots at every chance.
One-on-one, she thought that Omar was okay. But his constant need to earn Ryan's approval was getting on her nerves. A few more days like that, and she guessed she'd try to avoid the two of them altogether.
Well?
Ryan said, drawing the word out a lot longer than it needed to be.
I just got a notification on my phone. Remember that Undercity storyline that hadn't moved along in months? Apparently, there's a new dungeon that just popped up. Finally!
Omar said. Lisa was fairly certain he had no idea what Ryan was talking about.
Yup. I reckon if we hurry through the portal, we'll be the first to take a bite out of that sweet XP.
Ryan went on.
Most other assholes in the forums are grinding in the far north, I think. Fighting a werewolf insurrection or something lame like that.
Werewolves aren't lame, Mark complained quietly through a private chat with Lisa.
I mean,
she said,
they're everywhere in Staravos. There's no way to grind for items without aggroing like 5 clans at once.
Despite it all, she was interested in Undercity's storyline. It was clear from what little information had trickled out in the last few months that the payoff to it would be something big.
Screw werewolves,
Omar said, agreeing with Ryan.
All right, then,
he said. Rylan Silverblade III headed for the portal, followed by Ed's former wizard.
Enough chit-chat. All of you losers ready? Remember, new guy, stay behind me and do everything I say. You'll be fine.
They found the dungeon not long after leaving the second portal, the one that threw them out of the temple and into the city of Constantina, where they used the light-provided vendors to stock up on healing potions and new weapons for their characters. Ivalice Online featured a weapon degradation system, which was strange given the other gameplay features it lacked. But by now, every remaining player had accepted that Pantheon did pretty much anything they liked and ignored most feedback. The other thing that Pantheon hadn't added was an active compass, which always made finding the quests and dungeons a pain in the ass, but the community had learned to make do by sharing coordinates and landmarks. In this case, the dungeon's entrance was hidden behind a waterfall that led to a pristine river with a nasty current hiding underneath.
"Isn't there a secret exit we can use instead?"
Omar asked, while the other three discussed how they'd bypass the river to reach the curtain of water.
"That's not how it works,"
said Mark patiently.
"If we knew where the secret entrance was, we'd be using that one instead, and this would be the secret exit."
His stout dwarf character kept a safe distance from the river. With his heavy plate armor, he'd sink like a rock and end up teleported back into the temple, a hefty gold coin fee automatically deducted from his inventory.
"Besides, if you take too long to attack, sometimes they just collapse the entire dungeon and move the minions elsewhere."
"How annoying,"
Omar muttered.
"I wonder what the developers thought when adding that feature."
"It's probably for realism,"
said Lisa.
"But never mind that. Your character specs in ice magic, right?"
"Yeah, I think so."
Lisa suggested they use the wizard's magic to freeze a path into the waterfall.
"There's one wizard daily, Sleet Dragon Breath, that freezes everything in a straight line. It should have enough range, hopefully."
"What a waste of time,"
Ryan said with a dismissive snort.
"We haven't even started looting and you're already wasting a daily? Whatever. I'll wait for you inside. Last one in gets to be the loot mule."
His rogue climbed up the wet, moss-covered scarp like it was nothing, and disappeared under the waterfall in mere seconds, a feat that none of the rest of the team could imitate, since Lisa's cleric had spirit as her main attribute, and the wizard obviously used mind. Agility simply wasn't their thing. Mark opened a private chat again.
"What an idiot,"
he said.
"If something kills him without us, he'll probably blame us. Again."
"Then we'd better hurry,"
Lisa said, sighing. She returned to the party chat and said,
"Well, let's not keep the man waiting. Omar?"
"Ah, sure,"
said the new kid. Sleet Dragon Breath raised a small fog bank as it struck the water and left a jagged ice road for them to use. Omar went first, then Lisa, and Mark at the end. After the dwarf had jumped into and past the waterfall, the path cracked and collapsed. Rylan Silverblade waited for them at the end of a small natural cavern, filled with eroded stone covered by moss and lichen so thick that Lisa could almost smell it. There was a heavy iron door in front of Rylan, with an engraved monster instead of a knob.
"Is that a shark?"
Mark wondered. It was way too pixelated to tell, but the creature seemed to have a siege weapon mounted on its back.
"Probably a new type of monster,"
Lisa said.
"We better hurry inside. An underwater fight would be terrible with half of us in heavy armor."
"Just shock them with thunder magic,"
Ryan said as his rogue worked through the lock and disabled a pair of pretty obvious dart traps. A pit trap, which couldn't be disabled, was marked on everyone's screen once the rogue identified it.
"Mark, get this open,"
Ryan ordered, stepping back as the heavy lock fell with a thud.
"Aye, aye, Captain."
Mark jumped over the pit trap and charged the door with a bull rush tackle. The impact threw the iron doors wide open with the deafening clang of metal hitting metal.
"Hey, guys!"
Mark called, taunting the dark corridor that opened to receive them.
"We're home!"
As a response, a stream of imps flew out of the shadows as spiderlings flooded the walls and ceilings and headed for them. The imps were annoying, but Lisa had enough experience dealing with them. They weren't dangerous in small numbers, and they were barely intelligent, but they knew basic combat. They ignored Mark's fighter and Rylan Silverblade and headed straight for the casters, wielding those cruel tridents of theirs as their obscene songs came through the speakers of her computer.
"We need crowd control against the spiderlings,"
Lisa advised Omar while her hands flew over her keyboard's hotkeys and activated a couple of macros. Her cleric was the team's one-man army against all things undead and demonic. Had she been running her main character, she would have used a mass banishment that would have sent the nasty critters back to hell in a single strike. Instead, her mid-level character activated a circle of protection to keep herself from getting swarmed, then enchanted her mace with a holy smite spell that made it glow like a blinding star, searing the darkness in its wake and turning several imps to smoke and ash with every swing. A few steps in front of her, Mark set his tower shield on the floor and activated his challenge, an aura that forced any enemy passing him by to either attack him or suffer heavy penalties to their spirit attribute. His axe wasn't the best weapon to deal with swarms, but his endurance was so high that his health points barely registered a tickle as the spiderlings covered his body with bites.
"I can do this all day,"
Mark said while his character picked spiderlings off and crushed them under the weight of his boots.
We don't have all night, Mark. I've got a life,
Ryan said as he retreated past the dwarf's shield. The rogue was a glass cannon meant for infiltration, scouting, and dealing massive damage to singular elite enemies. And when Ryan wasn't the absolute best at everything, he got mad.
Hurry up and kill these stupid critters, new guy! Quick! Sure, sure,
Omar said nervously.
What should I use? You're all in my fireball area of effect.
No fireballs in an enclosed corridor,
exclaimed Lisa, Mark, and even Ryan in unison.
Omar, Ed had a minor spell for dealing with weak swarms somewhere in his hotkeys,
Lisa hurried to say.
Something to do with a fog. It shouldn't hurt us much, but it's lethal for the spiders.
She swung her mace again, destroying three imps that were trying to strike her character in the back, as if she couldn't see them perfectly with the top-down view of the screen.
Although, they wouldn't know that,
she told herself as Omar unleashed a freezing fog that engulfed the corridor for 30 seconds. Lisa's HP went down by a tenth of a percent. When the fog cleared, it revealed a corridor littered with the twitching bodies of the spiderlings.
Finally,
Ryan muttered. Lisa dispatched the last set of imps and laid down a mark of healing spell that recovered the party's lost HP over the course of a minute. After that, they hurried down the corridor, with Rylan Silverblade at the lead, scouting for traps under the cover of shadows. This dungeon had a low ceiling. According to the quest log, the leader was using it to smuggle drugs and cursed items into Constantina. Not that anyone besides her bothered to read the quest's descriptions. It was marked as a medium threat kind of dungeon, which meant the boss at the end wouldn't try to implement some of the nasty tricks the high threat dungeons liked to pull, like collapsing the entire thing over their heads, or flooding the corridors, or simply picking up shop and running away before they could engage in battle. It was because of these tricks that many players avoided the high-level dungeons like the plague, but Lisa enjoyed the challenge and didn't mind spending a week or two chasing after a tricky boss all over the map, because she knew that once she caught up with him, the victory was even more rewarding.
There's some shit-tier critters up ahead,
Ryan warned them.
Past that locked door. Now would be a good time for a fireball, actually. Mark, get it open so the new guy can have his time to shine, all right?
How nice of you, boss,
Mark said as his dwarf bull-rushed the chamber's iron door. The chamber seemed to be a staging area for transporting the merchandise around. Lisa saw a couple disassembled carts strewn about next to iron-ringed barrels, with a small stream of water splitting the room in two. It was guarded by what seemed to be man-sized carnivorous plants. Not that she had enough time to look before Omar waltzed in and unleashed a fireball rune that killed everything in sight. Lisa and the others worked their way through the dungeon over the course of 2 hours. Some of the traps were quite devious, and Ryan wasn't able to spot them all. The acid ooze that dropped from the ceiling and engulfed Mark when he stepped on a pressure plate had been especially annoying, because the dwarf lacked the agility to get out, and although Lisa and Omar freed him before his HP reached critical levels, he lost most of his armor and weapons due to corrosion.
Ha! What an idiot!
Ryan said while Mark burned health potions to withstand the lingering damage of the acid. Then the rogue stepped on another pressure plate and the floor collapsed, leading him down a long chute that ended in another acid ooze.
Whoever built this dungeon has a thing for oozes,
Lisa commented. 10 minutes and many potions later, once they'd managed to get Ryan out.
Remind you of someone?
Asked Mark through a private chat so Ryan wouldn't hear.
I'm just saying.
No one built anything,
Ryan muttered. Lisa didn't need to see him to know from his tone that he was fuming already.
Most dungeons are randomly generated, so this is all just shit luck and shit skill. Omar, please, next time you see an ooze, freeze it with your damn ice. That's how you kill them as fast as possible.
What about a fireball?
Omar asked timidly.
Do you want dozens of tiny, angry oozes? Because that's what you get if you use fire against one. Did you even read the wiki?
All right, guys, get ready. More junkers up ahead,
Lisa said, more to get Ryan's attention away from Omar than because junkers ought to worry them. Junkers, according to the database, were low-ranking demons above imps and below everything else. The bosses summoned them from hell itself to do their bidding. They were hunchbacked humanoids with a long set of claws instead of fingers, blind and deaf and butt-ugly. They detected prey through movement and smell, and if ignored, could quickly take out a spellcaster, so the responsibility rested mostly on Ryan and Mark to keep them far away and manageable. Which they did while Lisa and Omar blasted them to pieces using ice bolts and smites repeatedly. They were neck-deep in dead junkers when they realized they'd stumbled across the boss room, and only because they saw the tiny stone seat hidden behind a giant cobweb. In most normal dungeons, the boss room was the most important and luxurious single chamber around. It was the one with the seat, the heart of the dungeon, which, when destroyed, disabled most magical traps and the portal. In this case, though, the boss room was tiny, secluded, and partially flooded by a crack in the walls that let the water from the river above in. Cobwebs covered almost every inch, so much so that even the junkers got trapped sometimes. Ryan spent more time hacking the silver strands to pieces than actually fighting at all, and judging by his cursing, he was getting tired of it real quick.
"There's the seat!"
Lisa exclaimed.
"Quick, someone take it out!"
Of course, the boss appeared right before they could make their move. The wall next to them exploded out of nowhere, and a creature so big it barely fit in the chamber rushed at them, long and terrible horns aimed their way and blazing red eyes shining through the darkness. Its skin was black and bulging with muscle, with precise stitching holding together the separate body parts, some of which had clearly been taken from different creatures. Lisa yelped and barely had time to set a couple wards of protection against physical damage up before the giant undead bull smashed against Omar. The wizard's health halving with the collision, gored him straight through and kept going. The bull smashed against the next wall and continued on, disappearing into the shadows while Omar's HP kept dropping.
"What the fuck?"
Ryan bellowed.
"Move, you idiot! I can't!"
Omar exclaimed through the sound of frantic keystrokes.
"It stunned me!"
"It didn't even say its speech,"
Mark whispered. The boss fight was on. Lisa could tell by the change in music. She jumped after the boss, already preparing a healing spell. The bull had finally stopped in the middle of an entirely new room. The creature seemed to be grappling Omar down on purpose, right in the middle of an anti-magic circle, its field encapsulating both boss and hero like a translucent bubble.
"What the hell?"
Lisa thought. That was one hell of a nasty combo. Anti-magic fields countered spellcasters hard, and worse yet, dying inside one caused a final death, in which the player not only lost the character, but all its loot. Final deaths were represented in gameplay by a fierce explosion.
"Get the hell out of there, you idiot!"
Ryan exclaimed.
"I can't! My spells aren't working!"
Omar exclaimed, almost in hysterics. Lisa tried to use a healing command, but the anti-magic field dissipated the spell like it was nothing. For a bunch of smugglers, the creators of the dungeon had invested some serious gold in this trap.
"There are no creators,"
Lisa reminded herself.
"It's supposed to be all randomly generated."
Since magic wasn't working, she had her cleric draw her mace and charge at the giant bull. It turned out to be one of the most resistant undead she'd ever fought. Her mace, usually a perfect weapon against undead, simply wasn't heavy enough to deal with the bull's enhanced body. Its endurance was ridiculous, somewhere in the upper 20s.
"Get off him!"
Lisa saw how the last dredges of Omar's HP drained away. She tried to strike at the monster's head, but the creature kicked at her almost without noticing her, and the cleric flew away from the circle and into the wall's rubble.
"Do I have to do everything around here?"
Ryan muttered as he and Mark entered the circle and rained blows upon the bull. This time, with the dwarf's axe taking chunks out of grayish meat with each strike, and Rylan's silver blades curved daggers tearing open tendon and joint, Lisa dared to hope that they'd be able to kill it in time. Then the bull lifted the wizard with one terrible bellow and smashed him back down again with all of its weight behind it, several tons of bone and muscle. The wizard's remaining HP vanished, and Lisa could swear for an instant that she could see the pixelated body split. The explosion was so strong that, for a second, Lisa believed her computer screen was shaking for real. Pieces of debris fell from the ceiling and a cloud of dust obscured her top-down view. Not that she was looking. Instead, all her attention was on downing health potions and casting recovery spells. The dust cleared after a few seconds to reveal the silhouette of the bull,
its skull picked clean of skin by the force of the explosion, and the many wounds it had sustained clear on its undead body. It glanced stupidly at the broken magical circle, and then at Lisa's cleric. The monster raised a hoof and struck